So this week, in part four of our series on travel content marketing, we're going to talk about how to close the deal, how to have the phone calls that get your prospects to finally say yes to what you propose, and what to propose to make sure that they do say yes. And I know this concept of proposals is probably going to be new to a lot of folks, because I think usually when we're setting up writing gigs with folks that we haven't met in person or just generally in a freelance capacity outside of a day job, we don't send a full proposal, the type of which people bidding on a construction job or setting up an entire website for a company might send. But this is one of the things that can actually really set you apart from other writers, and also accomplish one of the very important things that you need to do with any prospect that you found cold through the type of research we've talked about in previous weeks, which is establish trust. So let's talk about how to do that. There's three main things that we're going to look at within the concept of proposals and phone calls, because they're very related in terms of their purpose. So first, I want to talk about how to focus what you say on your phone calls with your prospect and make sure that you are not doing most of the talking. Because even though I think it's our inclination to do a lot of explaining about how we work, that's not actually what closes the deal. And then we're going to look at the questions that you need to make sure that you're asking on that phone call to be able to write the best proposal to convince your prospect to work with you. And then we're going to look at step by step the formula that I use to put together content marketing proposals. And I don't think that she could join us this week, but I just wanted to say I'm so excited that somebody who's been doing these calls every week, Donna Long, she wrote me just yesterday to say that she has not been able to follow the at-home Pitchapalooza course that we're doing pitching magazines, because she's been doing pitches for this content marketing writing that we've been talking about in these webinars. And she says she's already landed one, and she has conference calls and emails scheduled with another six. So I'm super happy for her, but I just wanted to share that with you to show you that it's not that hard, and it doesn't take that long, and you really can get this type of work set up very quickly. All right, so let's dive into what we're going to talk about today. So we looked last week, and whenever we talk about pitches, we always start by asking ourselves, what is the real objective? What do we really need to accomplish with this particular thing that we're doing? And in this case, unlike our pitch letters, where the objective is just to get them to respond, the object of our phone call is to get them to make a very small step, but to ask us for something, to show not just that they're interested in hearing what we might have to offer, but that they are potentially interested in working with us. So when you send somebody a pitch letter, like we talked about last week, and you wrap up by saying, "Hey, do you have 5 or 10 minutes? Or we could hop on the phone next week and talk about how we could potentially work together." That's a little bit of an ask, right? But it's the kind of thing where somebody might do it just because they're curious, even if they're never really going to pull the trigger. But once we've had that phone call with somebody, and I'll give you some exact language on this at the end, when we ask them if we can put together a proposal on how to work together, that's them saying a more significant yes to the possibility of actually paying you to do some writing for them. Now, one of the most important things in this whole process of getting cold content marketing gigs is to not battle uphill. I talked in the first week of this series about all the different types of gigs out there, but then in the second week, when we looked at how to find them, I mentioned that it's really important not to just look for whatever is there, not to just find websites that need help, but to find the ones that you are the most well matched to. And the reason for that is that it's much easier for people to say yes to you if they can clearly see the fit, if they can clearly see you have the background, if it looks perfect to them. And it's the same thing with these proposals and these phone calls. We want as much as possible to be tuned in directly to what these prospects need. And so the interesting thing about that is that that often means that we're not going to do very much of the talking, that we need to do a lot of the listening, because it's by listening that we get the information that we need to put together the proposal that they'll say yes to. And so the entire time you're on the phone with your prospect, it's really important to keep in mind that you don't want to scare them, right? I think we are often scared making these phone calls. I remember the first time I pitched content marketing things like this cold, like I just sent out emails to people who had concierge travel booking companies. I can totally picture this. I had a different apartment in New York at the time. I was sitting in the on the couch in my apartment, getting ready to make these phone calls, and I was just like scared shitless, pardon my language, but like for no specific reason. I would, you know, if I didn't get the gig, fine. There was no thing. I wasn't worried about, you know, stuttering on the call or anything like that. It was just this sort of unknown. And when you have these phone calls, that is one of the biggest things that you can only get over with practice. It's gonna be hard every single time until it's not. And there's nothing I can really say to you to make that less. But knowing that, you can make sure that you're making it as easy for yourself as possible so that there's less to be afraid of. Okay, so on the call, and I mentioned last time that there's three things that we want to accomplish in our pitch. We want to let them get to know us, like us, and trust us. But the purpose of this phone call is to really cement these three things: know, like, trust, that you need to close a big deal like this. And so I've split up the types of things that you're going to do in your phone call into these three categories: know, like, and trust. Now, when you first get on the phone with somebody that you've sent a cold email to and they're curious enough to set up a call with you, there are some questions that they have that all revolve around why. And answering those questions is addressing the no part of know, like, trust. So even if they've decided to get on the phone with you, there's typically some things that they're not sure about that you need to establish a baseline level where you're on the same page about what is going on in order to move forward and conquer these like and trust signposts that we also need to get past. So the things that pretty much everyone will always want to know, whether they ask you or not, and they usually will, is why you reached out in the first place, why you reached out to them specifically, and why you can help them. So I think that we often get stuck on what to say in answer to some of these questions, and I'm going to circle back to that later. But first, I want to go through the next couple of things about know, like, and trust, and then I promise you we're going to circle back about how you ask and answer each of these specific things. So when we are establishing liking in our prospects for them to like you, and hopefully for you to also like them, but as an aside, if you don't like them, then don't offer to put together a proposal for them. If you see some warning signs, if they start telling you about these people that they've worked with in the past, and they start saying very nasty things about these people, this is a very clear sign that this is not going to be a good fit. And I talked in the identifying prospects call about fit and how it's very important, and that there's a very, very big sea of potential content marketing clients out there. And it's not worth your time to work with ones that are a bad fit, because there will be friction. It will affect your other writing. It will affect your personal relationships. It will probably, in the short, if not long term, affect your ability to get paid by the prospect. And eventually, the relationship will end and it will not end well. So you always want to go for the best fit possible from the beginning to ensure a good long-term collaboration. So this is why the like factor is very important. So as much as you're trying to figure out if you like them, you also want to get them to like you. And you do that by showing that you understand what they're going through. And this can be in terms of learning about marketing or social media, or this can be as a small business owner, this can be as an expat living in another country, somebody learning another language, any point of commonality that you can find where you can show them that you are empathetic of their situation. So you want to show that you have a similar background, but you also want to take it one step further. You want to help them see that you really get them, because this feeds into our next one, trust. How do we get, in a very short phone call, in one email or a couple emails, somebody to trust us? This is huge. This is the whole point of this phone call. It is very, very difficult to establish trust over emails. I can't even tell you how surprised I am at the differences that pop up when I've been emailing with somebody and then we get on the phone. I see this when I do interviews for articles. I see this when I do interviews for people to write for us for the travel magazine database. There It's almost like we all speak two languages today. We speak written language and we speak spoken language. And I'm sure that as writers, you all know how different the tone of your writing can be than how you are in real life speaking. But the thing is that how you are in real life speaking is how you go about doing your work. The actual format and style and tone of your writing is an end product that's been polished. So in terms of working with somebody, it goes so far in establishing trust to hear that person's voice and get to know their personality and understand that that personality is trustworthy. And that's why, no matter how scary it can be, like me sitting there on the couch freaking out about these phone calls I had to do, it is so important to get on these phone calls, and it can really make the difference. I can't tell you how many times I've seen people try to set up travel writing gigs just over email, and it seems like it could be a good fit, but people aren't getting back in time and things like this. It's not sticky. If you don't feel like you know the person and like them and trust them, the prospect isn't incentivized to work with you to start that project. And so the most important way we get over that is getting on the phone. But once we're on the phone, we need to use our tone of voice and our experience and anecdotes about other things that we've done to show that they can trust us, to show that we go about our work in a professional manner, to show that we are calm, trustworthy, intelligent individuals that this prospect can trust with an important piece of their business. And one of the most important things that you want to do with these content marketing gigs is to show that you know what they need better than they do. And this is tricky. It's tricky in theory, but in practice, it's not so hard once you wrap your head around it. So I mentioned in one of the earlier calls in this series about how these, particularly if you're approaching small business owners or small tourism boards, these people are harried individuals. They have a very, very, very lot of stuff on their plate, and they would love for somebody to help them with it, but they need to know that that person's going to do a good job. And so in order for you to show that you know what they need better than they do and that they can trust you need to show that you know the subject matter better than they do. And we're going to talk later in the call about questions that you can ask them about what they've done so far. But it's an important line here to walk between giving them some suggestions or demonstrating your expertise and spending a lot of the call talking and making plans for them. So when we're talking about establishing authority and trust by showing that we understand what they need, I just want to emphasize here that it's important to do little hints. If somebody mentions Instagram, for instance, we've talked before about the example of doing Instagram for people, you might mention that, yes, it's certainly quite a pain that it can be only posted through the phone and that it has to be posted live at certain times, but there's X, Y, and Z apps that allow you to set up the post with the right tags and schedule it so that you only have to hit go at the right time. They probably won't know that. You're not making an entire plan for them about how to do your Instagram. You're just giving a tiny tip that you're familiar with that would make their life easier, showing them that you have some experience with this topic and doing it efficiently and doing it well, and that you have a deeper level of knowledge on this topic than they do. Similarly, for instance, if you're talking about doing blog posts for a prospect, you might mention that there's some great apps that are plugins for WordPress that allow you to schedule the posts in an editorial calendar, and they also give you additional levels of post status, so you can mark something as pending review or in progress and things like that. And you've found that very useful in managing blogs that have multiple review levels. So that's the kind of thing where you're just giving them a little idea, not necessarily something that they're going to run off and do without you, but that shows that you understand the ecosystem which you are offering to take off their plate. Okay, so I promised that I would talk about how exactly we're going to tell them why we've called them and how we found them and things like that. And this is by using talking points. So often these are sales positions, but politicians use talking points a lot. I don't think any of you guys are politicians, but there's a lot of different areas in which talking points come up. But I want to point out some of the times that you might not have thought about using talking points, where they can take this fear that I was talking about of the big unknown of phone calls like this out of the equation. So the first time I ever encountered using talking points, I think, was my freshman year of college, and I had a sort of sales job. And I still, to this day, do not know why I wanted to do the sales job, except that it was with a theater, and I used to do a lot of theater, and it meant that I got free tickets and I got to borrow things from the costume shop and all sorts of stuff like this. So this sales job was one of those horrible ones where you are calling people at home on their landlines over dinner and trying to sell them something. And to me, the way that I sort of set it up was that I was just calling people to ask if they had enjoyed the shows that they had attended previously and let them know about what shows they had coming up and help them to get those tickets. Because this is before you could just easily go on the internet and buy all your tickets and get the right seats and set up your whole season subscription to a theater. And in that job, the sales manager gave us these papers with talking points. And to be honest, I personally didn't really use any of them as my job went on. But in the beginning, I found them incredibly helpful for answering these key questions of why are you calling? Why are you calling this person? And what can you do to help them? And so before you have the fluidity with your subject matter, as in the services that you're offering, not just the subject matter of what you want to write about, but the subject matter of your services, it's important to give yourself some text that you've already written, that you've practiced, that you can say with ease when you're nervous on the phone. And so another time when I ran into using talking points seemed very different, but this is an important way that I want you to remember to use your talking points. So I went to university in Italy, and in Italy, instead of written exams, all of your exams are oral. And specifically, professors tend to flip open the textbook to a random page, point to something, and say, "Tell me about this." Now, this is completely horrifying. And if you think about it, like, how could you possibly memorize every single page, every single thing, and every single one of the textbooks assigned to you for your course? It's, a feat, and not one that most Italians do. So Italians are known for being this thing called furbo, which means it's not translatable, but it's a little mischievous. It's like they find ways to get things done. And so the way that my Italian program director taught us to approach these exams was to pivot. Whatever they've asked you about, take a topic that you've prepared, that you know very well, and find a way to pivot from the question that you've been asked into the talking point that you know well. And this is the kind of thing that, we'd see politicians do all the time, but you should use it on your sales calls. So if somebody asks you a question that you don't like, that's uncomfortable, that you don't have a good answer to about how they found you or why you've reached out or something like that, pivot to the answer that you've prepared. I'm used to them because I'm a journalist and I do a lot of interviews, but some really common and effective ways that I see a lot of PR people do this is to say these little filler sentences. There's one that's a really great question. And then they move on to whatever it is that they want to talk about. Or, "I'm so glad you asked that because," and then they move on to whatever they want to talk about. So those are some ways that when somebody's asked something, if you're not quite sure what to say, you can still rely on your talking points. And the other example of talking points that I just want to mention is, so when I used to work at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, I ghost wrote for the president and the chairman and some other folks. And I think if you've never been a ghostwriter at that level, it's hard to imagine just how much of the words that come out of high-level people like that's mouths are scripted. And so the former president of the university was a woman. I think she was the first female president of the technical university that we'd had. And these people have to have a lot of dinner parties with donors, with other professors, with visiting people that might get hired. They go to a lot of dinner parties. And I remember our president had not been in such a high position in her previous university, and so she wasn't used to these talking points. And I remember overhearing a conversation with some colleagues one day about how she was sucking at dinner parties. She was just totally uninteresting, and it was because she wouldn't follow the talking points. And when she did, she made great conversation, and people were really delighted to talk to her. But when she didn't, she was just floundering. And so I bring this up not to say that if you don't use your talking points, you're going to flounder on your calls, but rather to show that your talking points can help you map your phone call and make sure that you are covering the things that your prospect actually wants to hear and needs to hear. Because, like I said, they really need to know to begin with, before you start talking about any of your services, why you are on this call with them. And so make sure that you have these talking points written down and practiced before you get on any of these phone calls, because then you won't forget to cover the bases that your prospect needs to know and put them at ease so that you can bring the conversation to where you want it to go. So why is that? I've talked a little bit, so we've talked about the talking points and how you can help them, but these are the three, like I said, things to make sure that you have talking points about: why you're on the call, how you found them, and how you can help. But you don't want to talk too much about your services right now. The point of these talking points, as I said, is to establish a level of trust and knowledge and liking with the prospect, but not all of it. It's just the stepping stone. And so you should effectively get through your talking points in the first minute or two of a call. So say you've set up this call for 15 minutes or half an hour or even an hour. What are you supposed to talk about the rest of the time? You aren't, because the more information that you give the prospect at this point, the more opportunities you are giving them to create objections. Okay, so if you say, for instance, I just had somebody pitch me some collaborations that they'd like to do with Dream of Travel Writing, and they said a bunch of things, and my initial reaction reading the email was, we can't do any of those things. And I was so glad that we hadn't had a phone call about that, because if she had mentioned all of these things to me on the phone, I would just would have said, we're not set up to do that. We don't do affiliate sales, or I can't do that with the database, or something like that. But because it was an email and I got a chance to reflect on it and look at it later, I was able to think about how it might work. And so that's why I want you to save a lot of the stuff about specifically how your services will be set up for your proposal. We're going to get to that in a little bit. But what you really want to do on the phone call is to get the prospect talking and to get them talking as much as possible, because it's an annoying little bit of psychology, but it really works. People create endorphins when they talk about themselves. I'm going to let that sink in for a second because it's a little annoying, but it's true. And if you think about it, you'll kind of realize it. Some people are very shy about talking about themselves, but primarily, oh, I'm sorry, there's a typo in here. Primarily, people create endorphins when talking about themselves. So you want to get the prospect not only talking about themselves, which is going to make them feel good, and then make them feel good about you, but you want to get them talking about themselves in a way that will help you put together a proposal. So I've put together seven questions here that you should essentially have a little checklist next to you of things that you want to ask when you're on the call, because each of these is really important in helping you put together your proposal. So you need to know what they've done in the past with their marketing or their content marketing or their social media, whatever it is that you're pitching them. You need to know what they've tried and why it didn't work, or what did work, or why they stopped doing it. Because you don't want to propose something to them that they stopped doing for a very legitimate reason that's not fixable, okay? So it's very important before you give them any ideas about what you could do to know what they've done, why they have done it, and why they've stopped doing it if they have, or how it's changed. And then you also want to know why they started doing it in the first place. Because the thing is that I often find, this is a really crucial question, people tell you that they started a newsletter because they want to tell more new people about their trips. And the obvious response I have is, well, somebody has to sign up for your newsletter to find out about your trip, so how are you actually reaching new people? The point of a newsletter is really just to tell people that already know about you what you have coming up. So often they started doing the exact thing that you're pitching them about for the wrong reason. And they actually have something else that they need to be doing that would be more effective that you can help them with. So this question is really, really crucial. And the only reason I don't have you ask it first is because sometimes if you ask these why questions, people get a little stuck. Or they don't quite trust you enough to open up yet, and they'll give you some cursory answers. So I like to start with a what. In law, like when you're doing trials as a lawyer, there's two different types of questioning times. When you're asking a witness who's on your own side a question, you're asking them these long questions where they give you all sorts of information that's outside of the scope of your question often. You're asking them to testify, as they say. You're asking them to tell their story. Whereas when you're cross-examining, you ask these questions that are essentially yes or no questions that have to stick very tightly to the scope of what came up in the initial testimony from the lawyer on the same side as the witness. And there's a reason for this, because witnesses are inherently combative to the lawyer from the other side. That's why the questions are kept very short and to the yes or no answers. And the witness is asked not to testify, not to give more information, to only give a yes or no. So you need to move your prospect out of being a combative witness who sees you as the lawyer for the other side into a witness who sees you as a lawyer for their side that they want to tell their story to. And so you do this by starting by asking them very simple questions that are factual that they can answer before you really dig into the storytelling style questions. So once you've asked them why they started doing this in the first place and made some notes about the reason, and if you think there's a better way that they can accomplish that goal, and again, don't mention it on this call yet, it's something you'll want to get to in your proposal or perhaps at the end of the call, you're going to ask them some deeper questions about how their marketing works and how they interact with their customers. Because these are the areas that really show you what you have to work with in terms of content, and also what content is working best for them now and what content they probably should be providing more of. And so first you want to ask them what kind of feedback they're getting from their customers about marketing. This is usually a time where they're going to toot their own horn and they're going to say, oh, well, we have this ad in this magazine and people really loved it. Or somebody saw my blog post and they totally loved it. So you're giving them an opportunity, again, to say positive things about themselves. They're not probably going to tell you that their customers said their newsletter kind of sucked, because their customers wouldn't tell them that, right? It's just not something that would be shared. The customers would just unsubscribe. So then we're going to ask them what type of feedback they get from customers generally. And between these two questions, you want to look for gaps. You want to look for the difference between amazing feedback that they get about the quality of their tours and their high-touch service and how they go the extra mile, and the fact that people aren't saying that about their marketing. Because this is the kind of thing that you'll use this language to say, I know that your customers really value the incredible depth that you provide in your itineraries, but it sounds like they're not seeing that on your blog post. So I'd like to do that so that potential clients can see what you're going to be providing to them if they choose to purchase a tour from you. Okay, so this is about consistency. So we ask these two questions to see where the company is not currently serving their prospects as well as they are serving their clients, because that is where we come in. Now, the next question is a little deep for some people, and if they're still combative, they might not want to tell you. You might need to inject a little bit of like time in here where you talk to them, you know, about how it was for you to live in Africa or whatever you can say to get them on the same page as you. Because having somebody talk about how their internal processes work, especially for something delicate like sales, if their sales aren't what they want them to be, requires trust. So make sure before you ask this question that you have a good level of trust. Otherwise, you might just want to skip it, to be honest. I don't ask this question to everybody. It really depends on how the call is going, but it can provide some really valuable information. So if you get them to tell you how their sales process works, here's how you're able to work that into your proposal. Once you know what the steps are in their sales process, you can see beyond the content that you originally approached them about, what are some additional pieces of content that you can propose to provide that will help their sales process, like we looked at in the previous two questions, be more cohesive with the type of experience they want to create for their customers. But again, if you don't have a good level of trust, just skip that question. But the next question on here, what questions do customers typically ask, is incredibly valuable. This is where you get the content ideas, sometimes also the format ideas. So for instance, if somebody says that their customers are asking a lot of really basic questions about how the company's tours work, or how, if it's a website that gives you points for hotel bookings, you know, how it works if the person needs to change the reservation with the hotel or things like that. This is where you find out not just the holes in their sales process, but the holes in the sales process that they completely are blind about. These are the things that they haven't realized that their customers need to know, that they aren't working on the solution for, but the customers are showing that there's a need. So I find this question really useful. Sometimes people can't figure it out just on the spot, though. Sometimes they need to think about it for a little while. So if you ask them and they can only come up with one or two, just make a note to expand upon this later with your onboarding call once you do get the gig. And then the last one, this is really useful because we're going to do something that I call a Goldilocks model with our pricing. Goldilocks is, of course, in this terms, that there's a low end and a high end, and then there's a middle end, which is where they really want to live. But the high end, you want to give them to show them what they could do, to show them what's the next step of working with you. What is the upgrade? And occasionally people will just take you up on the high end right out of the gate. But this is where you want them to really start dreaming. We talked last week about story selling and how you want to create a picture for your prospect of what it will look like to work with you in terms of what they will get out of it, what they will achieve that they've always wanted to achieve that they haven't done yet. And so by asking them what marketing projects they've always envisioned or dreamed of doing and not had the time for, this is the opportunity for you to get some really meaty work that you wouldn't have known about otherwise. So I've had people, for instance, you know, perhaps I approached them about their newsletter, but they'd always wanted to have a blog. Or I approached them about their blog, and they actually wanted to build an internal website for all of their past and upcoming clients to see videos and interviews and all sorts of things like this. So these are the projects that you would never know about just checking somebody out on the internet. So throughout these questions, throughout everything that you say on your phone call, keep the mentality that you are interviewing them, not vice versa. And if you feel like they are interviewing you, switch it around. Use a talking point. Segue into a question. Because like I said, getting the prospect to talk about themselves serves two important purposes. It both gets them to like you because they're creating endorphins, which make them have a positive experience, so then they feel good about you as a result. But it also gives you really valuable information that you need to put together your proposal. So one of the ways that you can keep them from interviewing you is to use the ever-powerful IC. Okay? So when somebody says something they've done in the past or a big project they have coming up, there's a natural inclination to say, oh, that sounds great. Oh, I'd love to work with you on that. Like, wow, what a cool idea. Or, oh, huh, that's an interesting question your customers have. You know, I've seen other people, blah, blah, blah. And then you start testifying, okay? But the point here is that they are testifying. They are giving you the information. And so rather than expand upon everything they tell you any more than you need to establish liking and trust, you need to use IC. So when they say something to you, you have to think like a detective almost, right? You're trying to get information from them to build your case. And in this case, your case is the proposal of how you want to work with them. But you don't want to get narrowed into any one position on it. You want to not show bias. You don't want to commit. You want to continue to get as much information as possible. And so there's a really sort of interesting, again, psychological thing you can do here. Whereas if you say, oh, that's great, people feel done, okay? They feel like they've said something, you've liked it, and they can move on. Or you'll ask another question or something like that. But when you keep it very narrow, unbiased, and noncommittal, they feel the need to keep explaining. Because secretly, they want to get approval about whatever they're saying. Like I said, it goes back to endorphins. People talk about themselves, and then they get approval, and then they feel good, and they move on. But something that you can do here is get them to give you even more information, which is often the information that you really need to have, by not committing until you've really gotten to the heart of the matter. And this is really useful for questions like, why did they start doing something in the first place? Or what questions do they typically get from their customers? The questions that people aren't likely to give a super deep response to right out of the gate. So when they say something, and then you say, oh, I see, then they sort of feel like you're not quite satisfied with the answer, that maybe there's more that they need to say. They haven't gotten a gold star yet, and they'll keep going. And so I recommend mixing I see, the next question, and these small, oh, yes, have you thought of doing blah, blah, blah scheduling with Instagram? There's these apps that do it, things that build trust in you in almost a rotation, okay? So that keeps you getting more information from them, but also building trust, but really making sure that they're talking throughout. So the rules of thumb when you're on the phone call is, like I said, to make sure that they are doing the majority of the talking. And I put 80% on here, and it really varies with how long your call is. I have a lot of calls that end up going an hour because they just want to keep talking about things. If it's a very short 15-minute call, then obviously you'll spend more time talking than if it's a longer call. So just think of 80% as a low end of how much they should be talking. Now, the second thing is not to quote any numbers. So I've talked about not giving them too specific of an idea of how you could work together, because that can lead to them coming up with objections and things like that. But you also want to be really clear about not giving any numbers. So the party line on this, if they ask you how much something would cost, you say, "I'll have to look over it and give it a think." Well, that's a bit of a British construction, but you can say, "I'll have to look over it and think about it, and I'll put together a proposal and get back to you." But you never want to give them a number on the phone. And you always want to make sure that you're showing them that you don't want to give them a number because you're a professional, not because you don't know. So this is why you always want to couch any negative response to this question with consideration, with telling them that you need to look over your notes, with telling them that you want to look at some different options that might be a fit for them. Things that make them think that you taking this time to come back to them with a number is beneficial for them, not a stalling technique, okay? And the thing is, it is both, okay? It is going to be beneficial for them, but it is also a stalling technique, because you don't want to give them a number on the phone that doesn't comprise everything you might have to do for this project that would be too low, because it's not going to benefit them in the long term if you're doing something for a rate that you don't feel good about, okay? So even though it is a little bit of a stalling technique, it is beneficial for the prospect in the long run. So make sure that you keep that win-win attitude in mind when you say that. Now, to get off the phone, just like with your prospecting email where you have a very simple ask at the end, "Can we just hop on the phone?" I recommend a very, very simple close. "I want to think about this and send you a collaboration proposal detailing a few options for how we could work together at different price points, like a menu. Would that be okay?" And then all they have to say is sure. Some things that they might say instead are, "Oh, I'll have to talk to my business partner and see about that." Or, "I'm not sure that I'm ready to move forward with this at this time." Or, "Well, it would depend how much it is, because I'm not sure if we have the budget." Now, if you get any responses like that, if people can't say yes to you spending some time putting together a proposal for them to consider, this is one of those huge red flags that I talked about. Okay? If they won't even let you put together a proposal for them, they are going to stammer and dig in their heels at all phases, not just of the sales process, but of actually setting up a process for working together. So if you get a whiff of any of those things, if after a great conversation where they've been talking and telling you their whole business story and, you know, all of their concerns and all of their dreams, they're not sure, it's possible that you have not completely checked off all the no, like, trust boxes, but it's more possible that they're just going to be a PETA, which is a pain in the ass client. And I got this from Laura Formichelli, who's a great freelance writing coach. And you want to avoid PETA clients like the plague, because they will take up so much more time than good clients, and they will negatively affect your energy about your work and in life and your relationships. And so if after all of this great time that you've spent together getting them to build up their endorphins and talking about themselves, they can't say yes to you asking a very simple question about whether you can send them a proposal, then you just say, "Great, thank you so much for your time, and let me know if you change your mind in the future." Don't get attached to it. Don't care. They're not good for you. If they can get over themselves and realize that they need to work with other skill providers who have ideas and concepts and backgrounds that they don't have, great. But right now, you don't care about them. They're a bad client. And that is why we do qualification calls. Okay, so assuming they're not a bad client and they said, "Sure, let's look at how to build that proposal." Now, when I do proposals, I try to turn them around within 24 hours after the call. You don't want to send it too soon because it looks like you haven't worked too hard on it, but you also don't want to send it too long because you want to strike while the iron is hot, as they say. But it's not necessarily in terms of momentum. It's more that you want to capitalize on that goodwill you created by building the like portion of your call. So I'm going to tell you the seven sections that I include in my proposals, and then we're going to look just quickly over a sample proposal that I have in the six-figure travel writing roadmap book. I think we have four different sample content marketing proposals in the back for different types of work. And once we've looked at those, again, very quickly, I'm going to go back to the same slide and talk very specifically about each of the things, okay? All right, so I tried to cut and paste the PDF that I use, but it is obviously letter instead of landscape, so it didn't go too well into PowerPoint, so I just cut and pasted the content. So it's a little wonky here at the top, but you get the idea. So I call these collaboration proposals rather than, I'm not sure what else you would use, like a just proposal or something like that, because I want to emphasize the idea that work is involved from both parties. Even if you are quote unquote just writing blog posts for a client, they need to approve the ideas. They potentially need to be the one posting the blog. There's involvement from them. And so I really try from the get-go to make it clear that this is a collaboration, that we are professionals that specialize in different things, and we're working together. So that's why I have that at the top. Now, in terms of who you should be addressing with the address on here, this proposal to, it depends on what the company is, right? If it's sort of a one-person owned concierge travel booking company, that's very easy. But if it's a larger entity, you want to make sure, and I didn't talk about this before because I don't think that too many of you are pitching big companies at this point, but you want to make sure that the person you're talking to is a decision maker. So if you had that great phone call with somebody from a large company, at the end, I would recommend that that last sentence not just be, "Hey, can I send you a proposal?" but rather be, "Hey, it was such a pleasure talking to you today and talking and hearing some ways that we might be able to work together. If I were to put together a collaboration proposal, would you be the person that could approve the budget for that? Or is there someone else I would need to talk to?" So don't send a proposal unless you are sending it to somebody who can say yes. Because if you send a proposal and it has to go up to somebody else, what happens is that the proposal you've put together is based on the information you have provided or that has been provided by someone else. So it is not going to resonate with that decision maker. And the whole point of that long call that we had is to get the information that you need to show the prospect that you're going to make their content marketing dreams come true. So if that person ends up not being the right person, not the one to give you the exact language that's going to resonate, you need to figure out who that is before you write the proposal. And you can certainly take the content of that call and use it, but you need to get the dreams, the struggles, the questions, the holdups, the roadblocks of the person who's going to spend the money and put that in your proposal. All right? So with this two section, it's going to be whoever you talk to. And make sure that you talk to the person who can spend the money. Otherwise, circle back and do the phone call again. Now, for the project section here, this is, I always keep it very short, one line. We're going to see on the next page that the scope is much, much longer than what you see here. The project section, I try to keep that very brief. Sometimes you're going to be proposing multiple projects or multiple sections. I had a client that wanted to do, like I mentioned, this internal website for their past clients and their future clients with interviews with the hotel and restaurant owners and all sorts of other destination content like that, and also some things on their blog. So in that case, I would list two projects here. Now, the scope is the part that A, protects you, B, really shows that you're professional, and C, keeps you from hating yourself 6 months down the line. This is really, really important because if you haven't heard of the concept of scope creep, this is when a client has asked you to do one thing, you've agreed on a rate, and then they just keep piling up more and more and more and more things. And this is something that can be really difficult to guard against if you're new, if you haven't done this type of work before, which is why we put the four different collaboration proposals in the six-figure travel writing roadmap so you could see the different types of things that you should include in your scope. So for this one, it's work for hire content for a blog, and I'll talk more about work for hire in a second. But so for the blog, anytime you're pitching blog posts, you want to be really clear on a couple things. You want to be clear on if the blog posts need to be approved before they're going to be posted, who is going to be doing the posting, who is going to put it into WordPress, who's going to find the images, all these little additional things that can end up taking just as long to write the blog post that you could forget to bill for. Additionally, and here I've mentioned that we will be deciding collaboratively on the ideas for the blog posts. So if this is something that you're going to be doing, make sure that you mention that upfront and make sure you charge more for it, okay? Because just writing a blog post based on a topic assigned by the client is very different than doing research on keywords and common questions and things like that to put together the schedule. And you don't want to find down the line that the client starts asking you to do that and it's not been included in your proposal. Likewise, I highly suggest that you include it in your proposal because a lot of the times when people have blogs that have been floundering, it's because they really don't know what a blog post should be about. And for the blog post that you're writing to be successful and for them to be happy with the work that you're doing, it would be much better for you to be coming up with the ideas. So some other things to put in the scope, like I said, are who will be finding the photos, who will be posting the blog post, how many rewrites are allowed. This is a big one, okay? I have, for the Travel Magazine database, I have a pretty clear policy that I don't, as the editor, I'm not going to do more than one round of edits. So that means that if you can't make something that's ready to go in one round of edits, then I can't use it. But a lot of people who are not used to being writers think that they can just ask for edits like 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 10 times until they like it. So as the writer, you need to protect yourself from that. You need to make it very clear how many rounds of edits are allowed and what happens if they want to surpass that. And so I've said that if you go past a certain round of edits, it'll trigger a fee billed at an hourly rate. That's one way to go around it. But it's really important that whatever you choose to do here, like I said, doesn't scare your prospect. And also, you want to keep this in line with what type of prospect you have. So sometimes you have people you can see are a bit chatty, but they trust you. So in this case, you might want to give them, you know, up to 3 rewrites because you know that you might have to do that in the first couple, but then they'll stop looking at it because they'll just trust you to run the blog for them. So while I definitely recommend having something on rewrites in there, it's something that you need to feel out a little bit based on the prospect. So in this case, we have a different number of blog posts during a specific period, which is the big marketing push for the company. This is not something that you're going to have in every proposal, but it's something that I recommend considering because a lot of companies have a very specific time when they're doing more marketing versus times that they have their clients out on tours or the hotels are very booked and things like that, and they are busy with other matters and they don't care as much about their marketing. So this might be a way for you to get some additional income by doing more blog posts or social media posts or what have you during a certain time of year. So the next thing after scope, so if you think about it, scope is kind of going to be like the work process, but the deliverables are the work products. So this is where I outline very specifically what exactly the client is going to get. And I don't just say 6 blog posts, 8 blog posts. I say the word count. I say what they will cover. And I've given them all names. There's postcards, there's guideposts, there's service posts. So I've really created a picture for the client when I talk about these deliverables about what they're going to get so they can start to envision their blog populated with these different things. And then something that I think we often forget about when we're proposing to do a certain number of things for a client on a weekly or monthly basis is that not every month has the same number of work days. Every week does, but not every month. It's approximately 22. But it depends. And so I make sure to have something in there to allow for those extra days that can happen in the month. And this is just one of these things, like I said, that shows the client that you've thought about how this works, that you have experience and they can trust you to take these things over. Now, the terms. This is super important. So never, ever, 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 ever sign anything for sure that doesn't specify when you're going to get paid. But also, make sure that your clients have seen this when you choose to move forward. Because I found that I've put in the terms, you know, that it's on the 1st and the 15th, and they just keep trying to pay me on the 15th and totally forget about the 1st. And I'm like, no, we need something in the beginning. Or that in their head, they think they're going to do it with bank transfers, which have horrible fees, especially if the money is going overseas. So this is something that you want to have in there so that you can refer back to it. So never fill out a proposal without this. I know that it can be a little scary, but it will really protect you later down the line. Now, the timeline. So these are a little hard And I often find that I put them in the proposal and then they don't end up working as we discussed in practice, because people's schedules change, or they don't actually need to review everything, or something like that. But I like to have a timeline in there, again, because it shows the prospect that you have a process, that you've thought about how it's going to work, and you're a professional. Now, the estimated fees, it's way, way, way far down, and it's a whole paragraph, but this is where we finally tell the prospect what we're going to charge them, okay? And the reason that I keep it in this section a little hidden after we've painted this whole picture for them of what we're going to provide is because that's not the point. The fee is not the point of the proposal. The point of the proposal is how you're going to work together. And that's really what you want the client to be focusing on, the how, the what, not just the money. And so we don't put it here to hide it or because it's not important, but because we want to dissuade people from scrolling all the way down to the bottom of the proposal, looking at the number and saying no immediately. We want them to look at what you've included so that you can have a conversation about it. Because that's the thing about this proposal. It's not a be-all end-all. It's the beginning of a conversation. And so the one that I've included here in the book doesn't have this, but if we go back to this deliverables section here, typically when I send something out like this, the deliverables will have three different options, which is this Goldilocks thing that I talked about. And so this one I've included here is taken from a later draft of a proposal or the particular client. But in the early draft, I had proposed to them, I want to say it was only one post a week, three posts a week, and two posts a week. And then they came back to me and said, we'd like to have more during our prime marketing period. Can you put together something that encompasses that? We'd like something between option B and option C. And so this was what I came back to them with. But usually what I would have in here are three different options. And so in this case, it's just a blogging proposal. And so the options would just be different numbers of blog posts, or different lengths of blog posts, or different types of blog posts. But if you're doing a proposal that includes different things, such as doing their newsletter and their Twitter and their blog and their Facebook posts, you're going to have in here a pretty diverse menu where on the low end, the baby bear end, you're going to have a bare minimum number of things that you would be comfortable doing. So, for instance, I don't recommend ever working with a client for blog posts for less than one blog post per week because they're not going to see results and they're going to end up ending the collaboration. So I would definitely say four blog posts per month is the least that you should quote anybody. On the high end, like the sky's the limit, right? You can quote them two blog posts a day. But you don't want to give them a proposal for something that seems outside of A, what they'll pay for, and B, what would work for the size of their business. So when you put together these deliverables and you put together the three Goldilocks options, this is where you go back to your notes and you look at their dream marketing projects that they've mentioned to you. You look at what they've done in the past that has or hasn't worked, and you find a couple different options that are better than what they're doing now, that are the highest possible option that they might want to do someday, and then the middle, the mama bear, the one that they are most likely to actually do right now. And the reason that we pick three, there's all sorts of studies about this, but the reason that we pick three is because, on the one hand, like I said, if they choose something lower on the totem pole, you want to let them see what they can upgrade to, but it also creates a bit of psychological movement. You want them to look at the lower one and the price and say, oh yeah, I think we can afford this. But then look at all of the other things that they could get in a higher package and say, I don't think we can do the highest level package, but it does sound really great. Maybe we can do the middle one for now. So that's why we do this Goldilocks in the deliverables. And so to go back to where we are on the estimated fees, like I said, in this case, they've got extra ones during the main marketing period and then the normal amount. But otherwise, you could say estimated fees for deliverable proposal one would be this much, deliverable proposal two would be this much, proposal three would be this much. And when I create these different deliverable proposals, I typically give them a name. And I make it a name that is evocative. So, for instance, I would say if we're doing blog posts and it's the option between one blog post a week, two blog posts a week, or three blog posts a week, I might call the lower one consistent content marketing. I might call the higher one staying top of mind for clients with evocative posts. And I might call the middle one a sustained content marketing pace, or something like this. I want to give them all names because I don't want them to just be numbers. I don't want them to just for the client be a number, whether it's price or blog post. I want them to be an experience. And so I recommend that as you put together your deliverable buckets that we've seen here before, you give each of them a name like that so that when you talk to the client, you're not saying the $500 package or the $2,000 package. You're saying, oh, so let's talk about how we can work on the sustained content package or something like that, because it keeps these scary numbers from not appearing in the conversation so much. So, like I said, there's seven things that you want to include in there. The people involved, making sure you have the right one, the project or projects, if you're going to be doing more than one thing for them, the very specific details of how you will work together and the scope, and also what you will provide for them, preferably in a menu, in the deliverables, a timeline detailing how the process would work specifically for a typical month, the estimated fees that you would charge, and the terms of how they can pay you. And with that, I'm going to say thank you so much for joining us today. And if you have any questions, send them to me at questions@dreamoftravelwriting.com. And I hope you guys all have a great weekend. Bye-bye.